Welcome to the Approaching the Natural podcast with Sid Garza-Hillman and sponsored by the Stanford Inn Eco Resort on the Mendocino coast of California. Sid is a certified nutritionist, health coach, and author of Approaching the Natural, a health manifesto, out now on Roundtree Press. Sid is also the programs director at the Stanford Inn's Mendocino Center for Living Well, one of the most holistic and integrated wellness centers in the country. The Approaching the Natural podcast explores all aspects of human health, including nutrition, movement, mindfulness, art, and much more.
Hello, small steppers. This is Sid Garza-Hillman once again with the Approaching the Natural podcast, where each week I come on here and discuss my philosophy of health and happiness and my approach to it. I am the small step advocate, so you're going to hear me talk often about small steps and how to ease your way into true sustainable change in the direction of increased health and happiness. So that's interestingly or not about all I'm going to say on the subject this week, because if you're just joining me, I do urge you to go back and listen to any and all episodes. You'll find when you do that I sprinkle in interviews here and there, and just to keep things interesting. And frankly, when I find somebody that interests me, my only criteria basically for interviews is if I come across somebody, I go, dang, that's about it. Just literally stop there. Just go, dang. And then I email them, go, hey, I said dang about you. What do you want to do a thing on the thing? And they go, yeah, or not. And this gentleman that I'm interviewing today is named Joshua Catcher. And I found out about him through a mutual acquaintance of ours. And it was through actually a radio show that he was on, and it as part of a group. This is what picked my interest. It was sort of a, I think it was a story on, I listened to some of it, but it's a story on masculinity and plant-based diet, actually. And this kind of came up early on in my career, especially when my book came out. As you all know, my last name is Garza-Hillman. And for any of you who don't know, the reason it's hyphenated is because my wife and I joined our names. And we've been married almost 20 years. And there has been many occasions, and I go into this a little bit in the podcast interview that you're about to hear, but where I'm sort of been criticized or made fun of as being not manly because I joined names with my wife. And so it's sort of been this thing along the way of going, huh, how interesting that that's perceived that way, a principled decision on my part and my wife's part, and that it's perceived that way. And then somebody made a comment on it when I did a podcast interview years ago, like, oh boy, here we go again. And I found that there is a sort of an underlying, I'll just say, trend, or maybe just a reality, and I don't know what size of reality this is. It doesn't really matter, but there is sort of in the health world, the health and happiness world, and even in athletics, and obviously in the triathlon kind of, you know, that whole world too, there's this kind of machismo thing going on. Obviously not with everybody, but it certainly got focused my way. It has over the years. And so when I came across Joshua Catcher, I thought, well, how interesting this is. So now that you're seeing, you know, people, and this is not a vegan podcast, as you know, it's not even a plant-based podcast per se. I do talk about increasing health and happiness, and I myself, as you all know, am plant-based because that's where I am in my trek. But at the same time, there are lots of, you know, people, especially in the professional athletics world, moving in this direction, and some of these athletes are, you know, would be perceived as being, you know, like mixed martial art fighters and things like that, turning into this kind of more heavy box food reality because of what it does for their bodies. But there is that weird reality that they are in these kind of traditionally macho kind of manly sports, and yet they're not eating meat, you know, whatever that, all it plays with all these kinds of perceptions. So I don't want to ramble on too much here. Joshua Catcher really piqued my interest. I had a conversation with him on the phone. I wanted to get into the ideas behind what he does in his life. I think we went there. I hope you enjoy this interview. A little bit about him. He's called the Discerning Brute. He has a website called thediscerningbrute.com, and where he deals with fashion, but he's also got contributors in all sorts of areas. He's been featured in O Magazine, Alicia Silverstone, The Guardian UK, Oprah.com, Veg News. He's really all over the place. He's highly intelligent. You can tell he's really thoughtful. I love that. And he launched a clothing line called Brave Gentleman. And he talks about how to reach him and all that kind of stuff. And we get into it, man. We get into capitalism and gender roles. And I mean, I had no idea where it was going to go. Much like every episode of my podcast. And this was super fun. So before I leave you to this, I just want to make a quick announcement that real quick, follow me, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook. You all know all that. Sid Garza Hillman, SidGarzaHillman.com. Throw in your email, get a free chapter, buy a sweet-ass t-shirt. But my Spreecast is this Saturday, if you're listening to this anyhow, September 13th, 2014 at 11 a.m. Spreecast.com. I saw some people signed up for it already. Thank you, and I'll see you on Saturday at 11 a.m. Pacific for a live question and answer on video session. And that's pretty much all I got. Go to my YouTube channel, too, to see 3 videos, and I got another one in the works. So anyway, in the meantime, I wish you all well. Enjoy this interview with Joshua Katcher, the Discerning Brute.
Yes, I've been running around Manhattan like a madman,
and this is
getting ready for Fashion Week.
But you're also teaching.
Yeah, I just started a job at Parsons, also known as the New School. I'm teaching in the BFA Fashion program. I'm teaching a class called Fashion and the Narrative. And it's a pretty exciting class because I get to focus on my area of expertise, which are the hidden narratives of the fashion industry, the stories that are created that are often hidden, like the impacts of fashion production upon workers and the environment and animals. And this is a direct contradiction often to what the narratives that were told by advertisers and marketers that these brands and the clothing represent something entirely different than the physical reality of how it's made.
Would you say this is sort of getting ahead of ourselves, but would you say that that there's a conscious misinformation in terms of how they're going out publicly with their message? Or is it sort of like they think they're doing really well compared to other companies?
I don't know if it's malicious. I think that there are malicious people in every industry, obviously, but I think the majority of people think that they're good people and that they're doing, you know, what's considered business as usual and considered status quo and standard and acceptable. And that's the scariest part. It's not that there's these monsters doing these horrible things that we need to stop. The scary thing is that the monsters are you and me. It's anybody who thinks that they're just doing something normal. And what's normal is unfortunately what is the most devastating.
I just found that in terms of the use of the word green now has become so ubiquitous, and oftentimes it's for products that totally are not green, you know? So it's sort of like even in the fashion industry, I'm sure there's this ethically produced stuff that's probably not so ethically produced.
Right. There's a really big problem with greenwashing, and greenwashing is similar to whitewashing, where claims about sustainability or environment or ethics are made, and they really are more aesthetic than anything else. And I think for a while it was a marketing scheme for a lot of companies to use claims that things were made organically or sustainably, and then you look at the larger business model, or you look at, you know, what is actually going on, and there are some serious concerns. And the problem is that there really is no enforceable law or third-party organizations that are enforcing what these standards are for labeling something eco-friendly or sustainable, and there should be.
Is there really no, like I know in the organic world, because of course I work at the Stanford Inn, we have a farm, so we have to go through the CCOF, California Certified Organic, and that's a body, but it's not, there's different bodies that can certify organic. Is there that analog in the fashion world at all?
There are. I mean, there are independent organizations that are available to be certified by and to provide seals and certifications. However, the problem is that there isn't an overarching system, or there is no governmental body or political body that decides, you know, what are the agendas, what are the goals, who's allowed to make these claims without, you know, there's no enforceable, the only law that I know of that's enforceable is the Truth in Fur Labeling Act that President Obama signed into law, I believe, a couple of years ago. And the reason that got signed into law is because there was so much fur coming into the United States from China being labeled as faux fur or being mislabeled as raccoon, when in fact it was cat and dog fur, domestic cat and dog.
Wow. So
there's some real concerns with, you know, being able to make claims and back them up. And then if you make false claims, who are you accountable to? You are accountable to the consumer, to the citizen, but are you going to be accountable from a legal standpoint? What is the, you know, what are the ramifications? And I think that's one of the problems, is that there aren't as many laws that let people know that if you make a claim about something being green, that you can be punished if it's not. And in Europe, they have much more progressive laws concerning making claims of something being green when it's not. The fur industry, again, got in trouble in Europe for claiming to be a green industry, and they were their advertisements were pulled, and they were, I believe, they were fined for making sustainability claims.
Is this something that you personally are involved on a governmental level with, lobbying wise, or are you just sort of watching the industry?
No, I'm definitely on the more academic side of this, and I am doing research and trying to draw out what is the narrative here. What is this story that's happened throughout history of the fashion industry that has led to this massive global industrial complex that affects billions of animals and millions of people and ecosystems everywhere, yet it's written off as this fun frivolity? It's, you know, people say, oh, it's just clothes, it's just fun. Meanwhile, it is a serious, impactful industry that has an effect on, you know, all of us. We all wear clothing. And even people who don't wear clothing are participating in fashion discourse in some regard.
Yeah, and probably they should be the ones wearing clothing the most. Yeah. Anyway, okay. So
that could be taken in a couple of ways.
I don't know why I said that. Paul, talk about editing. Anyway, so I wanted to get, obviously, you know, we had a little pre-conversation last week, and I wanted to get into some ideas. I mean, it's fascinating for me, the portal of fashion, to sort of discuss what I was hoping we would get into today, which is the ideas behind the work that you do, the values that drive you in your own life, and why and how you came to do what you do. So I do want to back up a little bit and say, and ask you, what is your beginnings? Where did you grow up, and what was your sort of childhood? How did that inform what you do today? What was the chain of events?
I think I had a pretty average, you know, lower to middle class upbringing. I grew up just outside of New York City, and my parents are both public school teachers. So there was a real emphasis on doing my work and getting good grades and working hard and trying to achieve goals and really following through. And I really credit my parents for that aspect of my life. They really enabled me to be a hard worker and to believe that I could accomplish a lot. And I think without that, I probably would never have gotten to where I am today. So growing up in upstate New York, you know, a very, very typical family. I played video games growing up. I collected comic books. I was into music. I went to, you know, hardcore shows as a teenager. I got involved in the punk rock scene a little bit and the hardcore music scene. And I had two sisters, and we grew up eating the typical foods that most mainstream Americans eat. We would go to, you know, we would get a treat and go to Burger King on the weekends. We would have pasta and roast chicken and salad and, you know, things like that for dinner every night. And there was nothing too much out of the ordinary.
So you went to college. You're a professor. Where did you go to school, and what did you study in school?
I went to Syracuse University, and I got a Bachelor of Fine Arts in Video Art. And at the same time, I attended a SUNY school, the SUNY School of Environmental Science and Forestry, which was on the same campus as Syracuse, and students who go to one are allowed to take classes at the other. So I had an unofficial minor in environmental studies, and that ended up becoming what I was most excited about, but using my arts, my Bachelor of Fine Arts background to execute, you know, these ideas about the environment. And I had some really wonderful professors who really opened my eyes to new ways of thinking, really informed how I approach activism and my own life and the creative methodologies that I've found to communicate new ideas.
What was in high school? I mean, you said you played video games, but obviously that lasted through high school. Was that became a passion from a creative side? When did it cross over from playing to creating? Or what was your artistic drive even in high school or before that led you to pursue that in college?
I think it was really comic books that were the most exciting thing for me as far as art went, and music too. But I collected comic books and I loved the idea of heroes and these characters who went out into the world and tried to act to make change and change the world. And I was always fascinated with this very classic idea of good versus evil and that gray area in between, you know, is what is really good, what is really evil? Do those ideas really exist at all? And I think comic books were an amazing platform to think about those ideas and to think about them creatively and to also feel empowered and excited about the idea of what is a hero and how can you be a hero in the real world and not in the world of comic books. So I started drawing comic books and really having fun with illustration. And my father was a public school art teacher. So I was always in a creative environment, and I have, you know, people in my family who are artists, and we all grew up in a very creative atmosphere as far as art. Yes?
No, I was just saying gotcha.
Oh, I thought you said Joshua.
Sorry, no. Wow, gotcha and Joshua. I didn't even think about the similarity there. So that's what I was trying to get to, was sort of where the little artistic, I deal with creativity and it, a lot is as a balance of, well, I think it's a natural, I think the way we think is creatively is a natural state of the human. I think, you know, I urge my clients and also people who listen to my podcast to use that side of themselves, you know, to express themselves creatively, which I think a lot of that gets lost in the modern world when we get busy in what we do. But it was just fascinating to me that you took a turn, to pursue it. And so I don't want to get way ahead anyway, but I just had a question of, first of all, when did it cross over to fashion?
I never imagined that I'd be in fashion. And I sometimes look at myself from this perspective of being an outsider in the fashion industry. I didn't study fashion. I didn't grow up especially liking fashion in any particular way. I certainly participated in fashion discourse by being part of subcultures that I identified with. Gotten really involved in hardcore music, I certainly, you know, wore the band t-shirts and dressed the part. And I was very interested in counterculture aesthetics. And I think that, so in a sense, you know, fashion plays a role in all of our lives and in all of our identities. We make decisions about how we want to present ourselves to the world. And when people see us, it communicates something. But I never imagined that I would be a fashion designer or be a fashion writer or, you know, be publishing a book and teaching fashion at Parsons. That if you told me that 10 years ago, I would have laughed at you. I found fashion because, from an activist standpoint, I saw it as one of the most influential and powerful industries that form our identities and our ideas about the world. And initially, I wanted to make documentaries about environmental issues. And I was in video, you know, I studied video in college and I studied environmental studies. And I thought, you know, this is the best way to reach people is to make documentaries and just explain the issues. But the more that I tried, I worked at MTV for many years as a producer. thinking I was going to work my way up and eventually make a show that would be about young people doing inspiring things that would appeal to young people in the mainstream, that would get them excited about making change in the world. And I realized that the systems that are set up in our media, in our media culture, these corporations, the advertisers would never allow for content like that to ever reach the masses. So the harder I tried to get content like that out there, the more I realized how impossible it was. And especially through a medium like MTV, through a channel like MTV, they'll never deliver those messages. Their revolutionary message is a message of apathy, and
right.
You know, that it's cool and counterculture to not give a crap about anything, and right. So they're interested in creating apathy, and I was interested in creating action.
But you kind of answered the next question I was going to go to, which is, it sounds like the environmental, well, I would just say ethical considerations for you almost inspired your foray into fashion, rather than you going into fashion first and then reformulating your approach.
Right. I looked at fashion the same way that a lot of people look at fashion, as this silly, frivolous thing that is about, you know, it's about shopping and finding good deals and being flashy. When you hear the word fashion, these are the stereotypical connotations that are associated with it. And so I had that same perspective, but then I started reading about, I didn't realize there was a very serious academic pursuit of fashion from a philosophical and sociological standpoint. And I started reading, and this is only a recent development, you know, fashion in academia was not taken very seriously until very recently. And yet it's this overlooked, underrepresented and undervalued phenomenon that has so much impact. So I started looking at it and I became fascinated with how influential it was, how it created ideas about class status and gender and sexuality, and any ideology can be communicated through clothing. And then on top of that, how there is this massive fashion industrial media complex and fashion industrial production complex that are controlled by a very few people, in the same way that most any other industrial complex runs today. And that these people have an agenda. They're not just making clothes for fun. There is an agenda about maintaining power that is happening behind the scenes, and about controlling youth and controlling ideas and aspirations. And it's a really, really fascinating realm. So I saw it as an opportunity. There was a real void in the fashion industry as far as menswear was concerned, because I have a menswear line, Brave Gentleman, and there was a void. And I saw that if I were to create fashion for men that was aspirational and desirable and aesthetically pleasing, and it was also made sustainably and ethically, and that was the story behind the brand, that somehow you can tie aspiration and desirability to something that's aesthetically pleasing, and something that's going to potentially bring about real world change through investing in sustainable technologies and investing in workers being paid fairly, and investing in alternatives to animal materials being sought out and developed.
Yeah, I mean it is fascinating, and I want to touch upon sort of the behind the veil part of that, which is now getting into you and your approach in the world. When did you start to personalize? I mean, obviously these ethical decisions you're making in terms of how you brand yourself and how you brand Brave Gentleman and all these kinds of things. I mean, this is it's as personal as it gets for you, I can only assume.
Yeah.
Okay. And when did the changeover for you? Obviously, when did you launch Brave Gentleman, 2010 or 11?
Well, I launched The Discerning Brute, which was my blog, in 2008. And that was an attempt to create a space in this realm of sustainability and ethical lifestyle websites and blogs that were, I saw, mostly being geared towards women.
I see. And
we live in a culture where I think compassion and empathy and sustainability and these ideas of caring about others and caring about the environment is relegated to the realm of the feminine. It's considered feminine qualities to care, to be compassionate, to be empathetic, and it's considered masculine to be rational, to get the job done and, you know, bring home the bacon and, you know, do the dirty work that needs to be done. And this extreme rationality without emotion, without being clouded by feminine emotion.
Right.
And I wanted to challenge that idea. So I started The Discerning Brood in 2008 and started talking about sustainability and ethics and a vegan lifestyle from a perspective of masculinity and trying to appeal to guys who might have these feelings or these questions and not really are not able to find a space where they feel comfortable without feeling like their masculinity is being compromised.
Right. And we talked about that. This is why I wanted to talk to you, because it's sort of this new, I don't even know how new it is, but it is a movement that I'm noticing. And I told you when we talked on the phone that you know, I've been criticized a few times actually, but made fun of, and it's always tongue in cheek about the fact that I combined my name with my wife's, you know, that we're both Garza-Hillman.
Right.
And that was a principled decision on my part and her part, but I've been made fun of, you know, I've been married almost 20 years and it's been almost constant. But then I did Rich's podcast and some guy, you know, commented on, oh my God, now there it is, too much for me, you know, kind of thing.
Crossed the line.
Yeah. And it was, and actually it was quite new to me. Well, that wasn't new to me, but what was new to me was that kind of, framing masculinity in terms of that, in the health fitness world, there's kind of this prevalent masculinity thing. And I didn't even realize that even existed until my book came out. And so it is fascinating to me that you are not only dealing in principles that, like you said, are oftentimes relegated to feminine, but also in an industry that is, you know, at least perceived by many to be sort of feminine, like guys aren't into fashion, you know, that kind of thing.
Right.
I find that to be very interesting. You know, you do mention, you know, the sort of the rational kind of thing. And I would argue, and I'd like to hear what you have to say about this. I think it's completely okay and rational to make decisions that benefit the planet and that benefit our own environment and that benefit our own bodies. Where does that sit for you in terms of the use of the word rationality? To me, I think of it as our ability to reason and to make choices that are a result of intelligent consideration. How do you sit with that?
Well, I think, you know, the traditional definition of what is rational, it has to do with being reasonable and being logical. And I think, certainly it is reasonable and logical, especially today, to consider environmental impacts and long-term impacts. I think where it starts to get cloudy for some people is the idea of more abstract concepts like compassion and empathy. And those, I think, you can't measure. They're not measurable. You can't. There's no stock market for for the happiness index or the empathy index or the compassion index. You know, the things that are rational are able to be charted and monetized, and it's part of this larger system, which are the rewards of patriarchy, the rewards of a system that is completely based on this very limited definition of masculinity and what is rational and what is measurable and what is controllable ultimately.
Right.
And I think what you were saying before about you taking on your wife's last name and sharing both of your last names together, and that guy sort of poking fun at you, you know, what he was really feeling, I think, is somewhere deep down subconsciously, it's a threat to the rewards of the power structure of patriarchy. And it's threatening to him because he wants to know why you are questioning those rewards that you are entitled to that are normal and average, you know, that everyone else gets. And that reward is, you know, the symbolic ownership of the woman. And I mean, we could really get in deep into
this is getting to this. I mean, this is what, you know, when we both decided to do that, it was, I mean, I talk about this a lot. This is going to be weird maybe for you to, I'll make this jump, but I talk about food, you know, somewhat in my podcast. It's mostly about ideas, but certainly in the way we eat and the way we move and everything else. But with food a lot, we relate to food based on tradition and ritual, things that wild animals don't. They don't relate to food in the way that we do. We like I said, tradition or ritual. Well, the tradition of the woman taking the man's name, of course it's a tradition. My own thinking and just the way that I approach the world wanting to be as independent as possible and using my mind to question things like that. That was precisely the reason I didn't want to continue that tradition. If that's for people, whatever. But for me, I had gotten to an argument one time with a guy who was like, well, the Bible, you know, and he was like this Jewish guy and I was raised Jewish. It was sort of like this thing. And he was like, well, this is a tradition. That's why I do it. And first of all, I was like, well, 99% of the other traditions you're not doing. So why are you choosing that one to follow? I mean, let's get behind the veil on that. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. You're not kosher, but you want your wife to take your name. And so I think it is an argument of ideas. And it is an argument of, for me, of questioning, you know, tradition for tradition's sake and what that means. And I think that you're doing the same in the way that you're even just building your company, no matter even what you're selling. It just happens to be fashion. But I think you're calling into question a lot of what's accepted in the modern world.
Right. And, you know, and I haven't taken it to the logical conclusion, because I think in an ideal world, ultimately, I don't think that there should be gender identities or definitions that are limiting at all. And I think that I'm playing around with this idea of masculinity in an attempt to reach, you know, the mainstream man. Because I think that I've been criticized by some feminists and some eco-feminists for my emphasis on masculinity and for my appeal to masculinity. And I think that I completely understand and agree with the criticisms. And I think that any definition of masculinity is harmful to some extent. But I think we also have to live in reality and understand that the majority of the world very stringently follows those definitions. And if we are going to reach them, it's not going to be by being puritanical in our own lives. It's going to be by appealing to them in a way that is aspirational and desirable and exciting and makes sense. And I always say this, what is effective is not always what's correct. And I think you can be the most correct and be completely ineffective. And I think you can be somebody who's trying to lead people in the right direction and get them to take that first step or question some foundational idea that they have and not be the most correct, but be effective.
I completely agree. I mean, in my own podcast, I shy completely away. I'm not shy. I stay completely away from labels, because I think ultimately they're human constructs anyway. And so if you don't talk about the ideas, you can get hung up on the labels. And I think it's interesting to you that you mention even, broadening the concept of masculinity. I mean, at some point, broadening these terms blurs the terms. In other words, if you broaden femininity and broaden masculine, you know, why is feminine even associated with anything weak? I think even traditional feminism is incredibly strong. And then all of a sudden you're blurring over into masculinity. At the end of the day, it's all one thing anyway. But I think your point is that first things first, which is we can talk about no gender roles, and then every guy out there who might have previously been open to looking at things with more consideration is going to shut down. Just in the way that we can talk about diet, you know, labels of diets and labels of you know, in any category.
The problem is that the rewards of identifying with mainstream masculinity far outweigh the risks of abandoning it. And those rewards are almost invisible. They're part of our entire you know, civilization's ideology. It's you know, part of the structural foundation of our culture. So abandoning those rewards is seen as a negative and a something that's very that could be very unpleasurable and scary and threatening and frightening. So until we're able to offer similar rewards for questioning those things and abandoning those things, which is happening, you know, we're starting to develop both, you know, rewards of power and of, you know, whether it's economic power or social power or political power around challenging these foundational ideas. But it's still, you know, it's very difficult to compete against advertisers and marketers who use these definitions to frighten people and to make people feel like they need to buy certain products in order to fit in with their identities and to reap those rewards. With masculinity, with mainstream masculinity, I call the rewards the four B's. And excuse my cursing, but this is, you know, it's intentional because I think this is how women are referred to by a lot of mainstream masculine perspective. So the four B's of mainstream manhood are beef, which is meat, beer, which is drinking, ball, which is sports, and boobs, which is women and or womanizing. So those are the four sort of pillars of mainstream masculinity. And if you identify with anything outside of those, outside of sports and drinking and womanizing and meat eating, you start to stray from that very core center of what it is, what it means to be a masculine man reaping the rewards of masculinity. And other guys might look at you weird if you don't participate in reaping those rewards. And being vegetarian or vegan is one way of abandoning one of those rewards. Being gay or being a feminine, you know, heterosexual or being anywhere in between is another way of abandoning it. And not being somebody who plays sports or who is athletic or muscular or, you know, it's a really narrow, easily defined definition.
But what's interesting to me also is that it's not about the ideas behind, there is nothing behind, I mean, I agree, I'm not disagreeing with you at all. I mean, that is sort of the, you know, throw it out there. That's just what people are going to come up with, kind of that idea. But what's interesting is it doesn't even get to the ideas. And I think when you get to the values and ideas behind all of these modern world media driven kinds of concepts, then there is way more similarity than not. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. I think that in reality, there are people aspiring to live up to those expectations and definitions that are presented by those who are interested in selling ideas and products. And there, you know, there's much more of a gray area. And I think that a lot of people live in fear. I remember being a teenager and thinking, I can't cross my legs a certain way. I have to sit a certain way. I have to walk and carry myself a certain way. I can't allow my voice to go above a certain pitch. I can't say certain words or check the bottom of my shoe in a certain way without being perceived as feminine. There were all these fears around being perceived as feminine or gay. And I think, you know, now as an out gay man, I'm not as frightened of those things anymore, but I remember trying to live up to those standards and being terrified.
Yeah, which I think is interesting. I think if you get to the, like, I, you know, not to harp on this, but I think if when you get to the ideas of, see, for me, with my approach to health and happiness, I appeal to the natural design of our species. I mean, I kind of appeal to the fact that we're selfish in our design in terms of how our bodies are trying to survive and thrive and how we're looking for pleasure. We want to feel good in the world. I read a quote by you, which I'm not even going to read it because it'd be so paraphrasing, but that when you indulge, you said, like, even in like a great cappuccino or something, when you indulge in a way that also takes into consideration the effect of your indulgence. You weren't saying not to indulge, but you were saying when you think about the broader picture of your actions, it actually feels better. You actually enjoy that better. Well, to me, I'm drawn to that because I go, you're not trying to say you shouldn't feel good, you shouldn't do things for yourself, you should treat yourself really well, but actually you can do that better by considering the bigger picture. Well, that transcends sex. I mean, that transcends gender.
Right. And yeah, that idea that by considering others in pursuit of enjoyment, that you have a heightened sense of enjoyment and a heightened sense of pleasure when you do get to take pleasure in things. I think that that's a revolutionary idea. And I think it sort of goes directly against the mainstream perception of being a considerate, ethical person, that there's this idea that in being ethical and in being considerate and in considering the welfare and the well-being of others, that that involves great sacrifice and being a martyr and being miserable and not having fun and not eating good food and not dressing cool and not, you know, all these things. But the truth is, I enjoy my life much more now than I ever did. And I think the reason is that most people already have these values and they're not living up to their values. And there's a great source of unhappiness in that. And knowing in the back of your mind that the things you're participating in or doing are harmful, I think that is a great source of subconscious unhappiness. And then when you finally do live up to those values that most people already have, unless you're a sociopath, which, you know, they are out there, but the majority of people are not sociopaths, that you then experience much, much greater happiness.
I talk about that a lot, which is, I call it conflict, and the owner of the Stanford, and we talk about this a lot, Jeff Stanford, but, you know, removing conflict as a way to engage more fully in life. And I think that's exactly what you're talking about. I mean, my goal is first and foremost with people who listen to me and the people I work with on a private basis is to remove the personal conflict and to get them to a place where they feel better, because I argue that the better you feel, the better you can serve others, if that's your goal. Yeah. And I think that's totally justifiable, and in fact how we're designed. So again, it does come back to everything you just described is man and woman. You know, it's the compassion and sort of, and I completely agree with you. I think deep down, everybody wants to live better. The only question is how much in conflict are you today with that person that you already are deep down?
Right. Absolutely. And I think there are ideologies out there that are limiting people's abilities to do these things, and they participate willingly in these ideologies. And whether it's something that's sourced in, you know, Western religion, or whether it's sourced in a specific political view, I think that there's this association with naughtiness and pleasure, that things that are pleasurable should be naughty, that when you eat something indulgent, it's because it's naughty. And when you buy a fur coat and enjoy it, it's because you know you're doing something naughty that you shouldn't be doing. And I think that this idea of pursuing naughtiness, you know, this is based in like puritanical religious ideology, like that, you know, having a sexless material, like no materialism, no sensual pleasures, that sacrificing all of these things are part of being, you know, getting closer to what is holy and sacred and divine. And I think that trickled down over hundreds of years into our culture, which now, you know, you still see people doing that and getting a lot of pleasure out of feeling like they're being naughty in opposition to wholesome values. And the problem that I think a lot of people that are working in sustainability and health and wellness and and veganism and any of these realms that are challenging, trying to get people to consider these things, one of the biggest roadblocks is that It doesn't come across as indulgent or naughty, and people want it plays right into their hands because they want to reject wholesome values. It makes them feel better, and when we present ourselves as these wholesome do-gooders, we're the easiest thing to rebel against. We're the path of least resistance to them feeling like they've rejected, they've attained their fix on being naughty.
And I also think that the pleasure, the naughty kind of bad, like you were saying, I think that's I look at that sort of as the natural pendulum swing of making all the things you listed, like sex and sensual pleasures, all, making those bad. And to me, I go, our pursuit of pleasure is a natural state for us. Our pursuit of health is a natural state for us. If you squash that stuff down and deny that, then the pendulum swings wide in the way that stuff is going to get expressed, because it's going to get expressed.
Right.
And so it's like, it's going to come out anyway. So for me to actually bring the ideas to the forefront and say, okay, the ideas of self-service and taking care of yourself and feeling good are not only okay, they're natural and should be pursued in a much more open fashion and a much more intelligent and creative fashion, then the pendulum doesn't swing so wide. Then people aren't doing things that are, you know, negative to them. They're actually taking care of themselves in real ways.
Right. And I think that that's a really important and honest approach. And I think from a marketing standpoint, you know, our people in our realm of thinking could benefit greatly from understanding this idea of the pursuit of naughty pleasures. That by telling someone what you're doing is bad, that is exactly what they want to hear.
Uh-huh.
They want to be protested. They want to be challenged and questioned because it emboldens their feeling of being naughty. And they're not doing it because they're ignorant. They're doing it because they believe that there's great pleasure in naughtiness. So yeah, I totally think a more honest approach to not feeling that those things should be stifled, and also to make it known that you can lead a very indulgent and compassionate and ethical life.
All at the same time.
And they should go hand in hand. Being ethical and compassionate should be equated to being sensual and indulgent.
Yeah. See, and this is really an interesting thing, because those things are promoted as being mutually exclusive. And I could just completely agree with you. But again, it's not how we're marketed to, and the very foods that we're marketed to the most, like the what I call light box, but the junk food kinds of things are that kind of that naughty, like, you can't tell me what to eat, I'm going to go eat a burger, you know?
Yeah.
And I did a whole episode called You're Not the Boss of Me. Cause I think, you know, without really applying what I would call it rationality, but without really applying thought to our actions, we will sort of dig our heels in when we feel like people are telling us what we're doing is not right. And we're going to say, well, you can't tell me what to do. And we're going to do it anyway.
Right.
And to me, that's like it's a very dependent way of thinking instead of an independent way of thinking. You are, whether you do what everybody else does, or you're choosing to do the opposite of what everybody else does, you're still letting what everybody else does dictate your actions. And so it's sort of two sides of the same coin. But I think, I think that the strength of thinking independently and making your own choices in a rational and open way leads people very, very often to the same kinds of conclusions about how they want to live in the world. Would you agree with that?
I totally agree with that. I think that that's, again, a much more honest approach to dealing with these issues. And one of the issues that I see often, and that especially happened early on in like the 2000s, was when sustainable fashion first came to the forefront and became trendy. And I use that word intentionally, you know, trendy meaning something that catches on quickly and then usually fades away. Because it was presented as an aesthetic as opposed to a methodology or value, that this idea that something that's eco-friendly or sustainable looks a certain way, that it should look like a hemp sack or that it should be ugly and uncomfortable and scratchy and ill-fitting and all of these things that are associated with, you know, wholesome people who have no aesthetic inclinations. And that's how it was presented, that as this aesthetic that eco-friendly looks a certain way.
Right.
But the revolutionary idea is that the most exciting visionary innovations in textiles are happening in the realm of sustainable fabrics. And you can make the most cutting edge, you know, modern, angular, cool, multidimensional structures and creations in clothing with these new sustainable innovations. And the most exciting innovations in textiles and in cuisine, I think, are happening in the realm of high-tech synthetics and plant-based organics. And that is such a misunderstood concept.
Well, and I touch upon that a lot, kind of the new age. I kind of poke fun at this whole like new agey kind of thing, because what is interesting, and I think why you and I are somewhat kindred spirits, is because I do like the fact that there are, I mean, I consider myself fairly mainstream. I'm really not that new agey. I'm a dad. I got kids, you know, my wife and I, you know, it's like the whole thing. But what's interesting to me is the analog to what you were just describing in the fashion world is that, you know, health used to be sort of relegated to that kind of hippie, new agey, granola, Birkenstock kind of thing. And now it's moving into, I was listening to an interview that Rich did with Brendan Brazier, and he was saying the fastest growing sport of people who are converting to plant-based is mixed martial arts, and which is totally fascinating to me. Now, of course, they're doing it for purely, well, I mean, I don't want to generalize, but I think many of them are doing it just like professional triathletes and ultra marathoners and, you know, the Scott Jurek's of the world, because it serves a very real purpose for them in the context of their sport. But at the same time, it does speak to an openness. I would say MMA is one of the most, you would perceive that as one of the most quote masculine kinds of sports out there. Right, exactly.
It's about fighting.
Right, exactly. And, you know, and these guys are saying, hey, how can we treat, you know, maybe for the good of the sport, but still, how can we treat our bodies better? How can we recover faster? How can we perform better? I find that very fascinating. So I think it's sort of a similar trek, maybe even in other industries too, as we progress. That are going to move into more of the mainstream and less out of the, it is just becoming less out of the new agey and more into the how to live better in the world for anybody.
Yeah, and you can't argue with actual results. And I think that that's what is really changing, is people are feeling and seeing real results. It's not just talk. It's not just, you know, a scientific journal study, or, you know, they're actually experiencing these results. And one of the most exciting things about I started doing CrossFit 2 years ago, and I almost started specifically because I wanted to prove that I could be good at it and be vegan, because the paleo diet is so emphasized in CrossFit culture.
Right.
I was like, you know what? I need a good workout. I need a challenge. I need to be, you know, in and out of the gym in an hour and still get a good workout, because I have a really busy life. I'm going to give CrossFit a try. And, you know, and I'm on top of it, I'm going to have this idea in the back of my head that's slightly entertaining, that I'm going to try to prove that as a vegan, I can gain muscle mass, I can perform well, I can get good times and lift heavy weights, and then be proof that after being a vegan for 15 years, that I can still, you know, do all of these things. And that's exactly what's happened. And, you know, it's ironic. Just yesterday, I read a new study. I don't know if you saw this study that just came out. It was from, I think it was from the Journal of Sports Medicine.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's called the International Journal of Exercise Science. It's an academic journal on exercise science, and they put out sort of an alarming brand new study on the paleo diet, saying that the results were that a paleo diet intervention is associated with damaging changes to blood lipids in healthy subjects. So even despite improvements in body weight or a cardiorespiratory fitness, it was still damaging potentially damaging to their hearts and clogging their arteries and going to result in heart disease and heart attacks.
I mean, this is the thing of, you know, I criticize the paleo diet a lot just because it's ridiculous on many levels, most of which is that it's not actually paleo, but that's neither here nor there. I always say, like, if you want to go paleo, go out and hunt your own food. And if there's plants, you're going to eat those. And if there's not plants, you're going to go chase down an animal, but move your ass. You know, I call them Safeway paleos, people who walk into Safeway and buy their meat. You know, it's not exactly how the paleo guys did it. But, I mean, it is a question of, that study would be, you know, the difference between fitness or gaining muscle mass and actually being healthy. And of course, right. My goal is for health, and it does, like the ideas that we were talking about, it ultimately, when you talk about ideas and concepts and values, you, in every instance, I would say you transcend labels. And I think that, and I wrote an article for Mind Body Green once, which was how similar vegan and paleo is on many levels, one of which is that you can be super unhealthy being vegan and super unhealthy being paleo. Right. I think when you come at the health and happiness of the human species, you're going to find more similarities than not. And so it just, again, you know, it's science is just going to keep putting out articles that support those kinds of ideas. But meanwhile, we're going to have to, at some point, get past the labels and get into what we're really trying to do here, which is to live in a better way and to sustain life on the earth as humans.
Right. Well, I mean, the paleo diet has the benefit of just having really good marketing. And, you know, essentially it's the Atkins diet with better marketing. And I think the appeal of the caveman, of the primal, you know, essence of masculinity, the beating the chest and the grunting and the muscular, hairy, it's like, it's a caricature of masculinity, and it's not even accurate from an anthropological standpoint.
No, not even close. And the other problem I have, I'm not really railing on paleo, but the problem is that it also speaks to this kind, and this comes back to sort of the tradition of things. And I think that people are drawn, men and women, to paleo because it's what we've always done, they say. And so I think there's sort of this safety in choosing how to live when you say, well, if I do that, then you know, time, it stood the test of time, and we've evolved for millions of years, and we can look back, you know, 100,000 years and say, well, how are they doing it? Well, it must have worked for them. Of course, when you question what they were actually doing, that's one thing. And also, I made the distinction in a few episodes ago, I can't remember what it was, between what we've always done and what we've always been. And I think that to generalize a diet for no matter where you were on the face of the earth, I think is totally irresponsible, because I don't think we all ate the same thing every day. And also, what we've always been is a human body that definitely thrives more on plants, whole plants, that is. And the fact that we have always have a history of eating meat doesn't mean that it's been optimal for us. We've always done lots of things, like all the things we've always done aren't necessarily positive for us as a species. Oh.
There's many things that we no longer do that we probably should never do again.
That's right. There's things that we're doing that we've always done that we shouldn't do anymore. And I think when you live in the present and say, okay, let's assess the modern world environmentally and ethically, I think there's decisions that we can all agree, if we use our heads a little bit, are going to be better, and some that are not going to be as good. And so that's how that goes.
Well, I think to bring it full circle, one of my personal heroes, Carol Adams, she wrote the book, The Sexual Politics of Meat, and I highly recommend, you know, anyone to read it if you're interested in gender and, you know, and politics concerning animals and the environment and power and violence and all of these ideas. She said to me in a conversation that nostalgia is always sexism in disguise. So connecting this idea of what you were saying with tradition and paleo and, you know, the machismo associated with and the comfort of doing what we always have done, that that this idea of what is nostalgic is nostalgic because it's comfortable, and it's comfortable because there are very defined roles and we know where we are and who we are, and we don't have to question anything or challenge anything. And essentially, you know, the past, our past have had, were these very defined gender roles that were not necessarily fair or or fair, you know, especially to women. So that nostalgia is essentially sexism.
In that case, yeah, and I actually talk about the even on a very personal level with each person, on an individual level rather, that when you acknowledge the nostalgia of even food or things you've always done, not as a species but as a person. You know, I've always eaten this way. I've always related to my father. This is just what our dynamic is. There is a certain comfort in that, and a certain discomfort certainly in calling that into question and making changes in that regard. But there's also that liberation of not being tied to what we've always done, and that's essentially the way to make change in your own life, is to acknowledge the things that you are feeling comfortable in, and then to ask whether those are things that you want to continue doing or not.
Yeah, definitely.
Which I think is interesting. So anyway, I wanted to get into for you the idea of setting the example. Like, obviously you are trying to be an example in the world, in terms of, I mean, I even want to get into the aesthetics of you. How much does that play in terms of your level of fitness? How does that play into your ability to affect others with regards to your fashion and also to your message? How much do you work on yourself to communicate that via how you live?
A lot, actually. I work on myself a lot, and I think that also ties into what we were talking about earlier, this idea of caring for yourself, both from an aesthetic standpoint and from a health standpoint, that this is an indulgence, and it's sometimes seen as a frivolity. But in reality, I think caring about yourself and caring for yourself enables you to be in a better position to care about others and to help others, and also to inspire change. And what I found was that instead of always trying to make verbal arguments or present a study or present a text, I could be the embodiment of those things that I was arguing for. Instead of having to tell people constantly where I'm getting my protein, I could just be muscular. Mm-hmm. and then just say, okay, if you don't think I get enough protein, like how do I have a physique?
Right.
And dressing well, obviously, if I'm in fashion, there, part of my job is to appear to have good clothing and be presentable in that way. And I think that there's a lot of authority and power that can be accessed through dressing well. And a lot of people overlook that when you dress and present yourself a certain way, people automatically give you, lend authority to you. That if you wear a blazer and a button down shirt, somebody's going to take you much more seriously than if you are wearing, you know, a tattered t-shirt or something. There's a real language and form of communication in dressing a certain way. And I've just found that when I'm doing an event, or I'm speaking publicly, or I'm teaching a class, if I dress a certain way, I get paid attention to and taken that much more seriously. And I know that I'm playing into an overall system that I disagree with. And I know I'm playing into rules and ideas about power and that I would ideally hope would otherwise not be there. But that doesn't mean that I can't access them and use them for my own agenda.
That's right. And I wanted to kind of jump into the whole making money thing, you know, because I think part of it is like you want to serve, in a sense, a higher purpose. You want to, or even just to serve yourself better, which is to act more in line with who you are and the example you're trying to be. But also, you are trying to make money with that. Of course, this is interesting to me because I work at the Stanford Inn, which is, you know, also making an effort to have a money making business. You know, this is not a nonprofit inn. Like Jeff and Joan are trying to make money. I'm trying to make them money by running their wellness center better, you know, and how to sort of justify that versus, well, in other words, is service to others mutually exclusive to actually making money? You know, in that regard, there's always that kind of weird sticking point of like, yeah, but you make a living out of it. You know what I mean? Like, what does that sit with you?
Well, there's these blurred lines. I mean, there's a lot of crossover with movements where you have people who, you know, who are against consumer capitalism and people who are against any form of using finance and money as an intermediary between commodities. And, you know, we could splinter off into 10 different conversations just about that. But I think there is this general association that money making equals evil, and it's an evil pursuit. And I disagree with that in the context of our current culture. I think that if we're going to make, if we're going to have the impact that we need to have to make real change, that requires money. And that is a reality that is, you know, unfortunately unavoidable. And I'm sure that there are people out there, myself included, who hope eventually that we can evolve into a culture and a society that is moneyless, that is based on compassion and barter and trade and sharing. But we don't live in that world yet. And although it's important to start the seeds of that and to be actively pursuing those things, we also need to utilize money.
Yeah, for me, it's like I studied philosophy, so of course there was times where I was, you know, reading about communism and socialism and, you know, and even capitalism, and I never had a problem with capitalism. I've gotten to this argument a million times with people. I don't think the fault is in capitalism. I think the fault is in each human's, on an individual level, not acknowledging their need to feel pleasure. And the more that we acknowledge that and use our brains to put that into proper perspective, we can do things better. And I think what's interesting is, you know, especially in the business that you have with the Brave Gentleman, is that you're not trying to not make money. You're just trying to make money in a better way. And I think that's capitalism. That could be. Anyway, it's like idea-based capitalism versus greed-based capitalism. I mean,
anybody that has a job and is making money is participating in capitalism. Anybody that, you know, pays for a ticket to a movie is participating in capitalism. Anybody that goes to the supermarket and buys something with money, you know, it's sort of impossible to avoid right now. But yes, I think the difference is, though, when you have a company whose bottom line is not just financial. There's my business has two bottom lines, and I will, you know, obviously I need to make money to survive, and I need to make money in order to purchase the expensive sustainable textiles that I'm investing in, and I need to have money to pay the workers fairly who are constructing these clothes, and that requires money. So and those people should be paid for their work. However, there's a difference where if you have two bottom lines, one of them is an ethical bottom line and one of them is a financial bottom line, and you have to be willing to not compromise either of those things. And that's where it becomes difficult for a lot of businesses, where their only concern is the financial bottom line, which is an irrational and crazy idea that is based in this concept that the world has infinite resources and that is infinitely replenishing itself. And that's just simply not true.
Yeah, and I think that's that you do say rational or irrational.
I said irrational.
Yeah, irrational. Yeah, because it's just sort of like it's just not a reality. And I think that instead of faulting the system, I think we should look into what you're doing, which is to set the example, and even what I'm doing with the podcast or whatever, but just to try to appeal to people's to get them thinking about values and their own lives on an individual basis. I mean, you have the company you have because of who you are as an individual. That has nothing to do with an economic system at all. That's how you approach the world, and that's what's interesting to me. And I hope that there's, you know, more people like you out there. And I guess so. I just want to finish up by you brought it up, which is very funny, because I had it written in big bold letters on my note sheet here, but the concept of the hero, because I was talking to Jeff about this just like 3 days ago, about how, you know, historically there used to be heroes, even in literature, but also in reality, people that at least we embodied, they embodied a set of values, a set of strength, and that really did transcend women and men, and it became an embodiment of ideas. And I think that we lack that in the world today, at least not of a mainstream area. I think our heroes or people that are in the mainstream really have nothing to do with the embodiment of values, and so much as just being famous. You know, there's sort of that pre-achievement celebrity where you can post a YouTube video that goes viral, and you know, people are going to listen to your ideas all of a sudden. But I wanted to just kind of talk to you about that, just to kind of finish up with that. Where do you see the concept of hero in the modern world, if at all?
I think we're in great need of heroes, and in great need of true heroes. And when we think about what is a hero, what does it require to be a hero, the daunting thing is that it's a lot of work. It requires knowledge and values and consistency and a willingness to take risks, to take great risks, and to take action. And those are scary. Those are scary things to really consider and do. And there are people out there who are doing it, but we certainly need more. And I think there's a reason why so many people gravitate towards the aesthetics of evil and the aesthetics of villains. When you look at the fashion industry, there's a real desire to embody the villain, to be dark and shadowy and mysterious and sexy and sensual. And that is the fictional depiction of what evil is. And in reality, I think true evil is invisible. It is what is not seen, what is not questioned. You can only see it in hindsight almost. And the public, I think the mainstream perception of goodness is that it's boring. And I think in reality, true good is intoxicating, and true evil is boring and monotonous and invisible. So I think that our Hollywood understanding of heroes and villains are both exciting, but to be a true hero requires a lot of work. To be a villain requires no work. You can be totally crazy and still have access to power. So I think that's why it's easier for people to pursue being a villain, because you don't have to put in the work. You can just have power and not have to rationalize or justify it.
But the payoff, of course, is that living on principle and living strongly in the world, the personal payoff is also huge. And in the way you affect others, but the personal payoff is huge. And I think that that's okay.
The payoff of being a hero is much larger. And I think that the misconception is that there is an unhappiness and a feeling of never having enough if you pursue, you know, sort of the villain identity, where you're always going to feel slighted, and you're always going to feel like you never have enough, and it's never good enough, and it's never enough power, never enough things, never enough whatever. And it just becomes this sort of ravenous unquenchable appetite. And with a hero, I think you have concrete goals and you have the rewards of feeling really good about yourself and good about what you're doing and seeing those changes manifest.
Yeah, totally agree. You have the solace in living in line with your how you truly are.
I hope that didn't come across as an endorsement for being a villain.
Because... No. Yeah, half of my listeners are like, well, actually, villain kind of sounds good. anyway.
No, well, it's not good. It's miserable.
Yeah, no, I get it. And...
It's not real. It's just fictional.
The
villain, like true evil, true villains are, you know, people that are doing great harm in the world. There's nothing rewarding or enjoyable or pleasurable about that in any other way than short-term, you know, access to power.
Yeah, exactly. So anyway, well, cool. I'll leave with one term that I read that you talked about. I just wanted to quickly touch on it, and then but it's called influence magnification, which I thought was a really great. Do you remember saying that?
Was this during our conversation on the phone?
No, this was in an article I read about you.
Oh, remind me.
Well, you talked about is influence magnification, and this is sort of just to wrap up the whole talk, but that magnifying influence by virtue of how you act in the world, and that it is making a dent. And so I guess I'll just finish it up for you by saying that I appreciate what you're doing, and I'm always interested to talk to people doing things in the world based on who they are, but also at great risk. There's definitely easier paths to doing what you're doing. You could be making a ton more money in fashion, I'm sure, without doing it the way that you're doing it. But you recognize that there's a bigger payoff than just pure money, and it's making a stand. And I think that that's a strong way to be that transcends masculinity and femininity. So anyway, I just appreciate your time
Well, thank
and
you.
giving me sort of a context of how you came to do what you do.
I appreciate your time as well, and thank you so much for having me. And it's been exciting to hear about all the things that you're working on as well, and your ideas. And I think it's a really promising and exciting future if there are more people like you. So
Well, thanks. And
let's keep working.
I hope we cross paths. Why don't you finish up by letting the listeners know how they can find you?
Yes, you can find me at thediscerningbrute.com or bravegentleman.com. You can also find me on Facebook, The Discerning Brute, Instagram at Discerning Brute, and I'm sorry, Instagram at The Discerning Brute, and Twitter at Discerning Brute.
Okay, awesome. And you're out in New York, but your clothes are now in stores, or the best way to do it is to go to bravegentleman.com and you
Yes, the
can, okay.
best way to get my clothing is bravegentleman.com. Hopefully, coming to a store near you soon.
Right on. Well, thank you very much for your time, and again, like I hope we cross paths. Maybe we'll if you ever want to come out, Jeff has offered you an invitation to come visit us at the Stanford Inn.
I would love it.
Okay, man. Thanks a lot.
All right, thank you so much.
Okay, thank you.
All right, you guys, thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed that. Again, thanks to Joshua Catcher, and please go check him out. Follow him on everywhere that he is out and about. And I will be back next week. If you guys have any questions or anything, you know how to reach me, but I'll tell you again, in case you're just joining me, podcast@sidgarzahillman.com. And in the meantime, keep on keeping on. You guys are doing great. I love the emails and keep the feedback coming. I love it. And I'll talk to you next week. All right, be well. I'm not